Well, folks, another week has passed, and we are ready for another edition of Valley Edition. And I'd like to welcome Zaz Hollander. Zaz, where are you?
I am in the wilds of the Wasilla Bureau of Alaska Dispatch News.
Okay. Well, thank you for calling in this morning. And I'd also, I'd also like to welcome Mark Kelsey. Welcome, Mark.
Good morning, Mike.
And I'd like to welcome Terry Snyder. Welcome, Terry.
I'm in the wilds, if not so wild, downtown Palmer.
Right. And so this is a week that began, there are three or four different topics that I think we should address. And the first one, though, was the surprise announcement of a resignation for the superintendent of schools, the Matsu School District, Gene Stone. There was a special meeting called on Monday by the school board, and the resignation was accepted, and an interim was appointed. Do we know anything else, Terry?
No, not really. I mean, this is just one of those situations where someone has stepped down, in this case, a fairly powerful position, so it got a little more notoriety, but for personal reasons. And he left. He will be gone April 3rd. Lucky for the district, they have somebody capable who the board fully endorses to carry on. You know, I'd say, other than the fact that it's a problematic time of year, everybody would agree to that with the budgets and the information that's coming down from Juno. I think it's one of those things that organizations go through, companies go through, and when somebody leaves personally, when somebody leaves for personal reasons, I just take it at face value. I don't know if Zaz has more.
Yeah, no, that's a good read, Terry. We probably all heard the same rumors, and I'm certainly not going to traffic in those, but my understanding was that this was legitimately a personal reason. There has been a certain amount of theorizing that there's a connection between Gene Stone's departure and some potential problems with bidding on the privatization of the custodial and nutrition services contract. I don't have all the details on that yet, so I can't speculate there either. There have been complaints from the union representing custodians and nutrition workers that Doyon was allowed to submit information after the sealed bids were opened, which on its surface would appear to violate policy, but I don't know exactly what policy is governing there, and I don't know the details. So from what I've heard, there is not a connection between that issue, which may be an issue on its own, and Gene Stone's resignation.
I've heard the same thing. And, I think that if folks get to know Monica Goya, I think they will see a little bit of Dr. Promo in her.
Yeah.
She's very articulate. She's she's been with the district 18 years. So I think maybe as time goes on, people will begin to have a little clearer vision of the way the boroughs or the district's going. But
yeah, she is very capable. She was in the mix when Dina left. She's been around a while, as everybody said. And certainly the circumstances of Stone's departure invite speculation and rumor mongering. From what I've heard, and I heard no details beyond, the personal reasons are valid, and if you knew, you'd appreciate it. I heard that from a couple of people who I respect and who I think are probably in the know or close to in the know. So I'm satisfied, certainly, that that's what it was.
Okay. So one of the fallouts, though, that the new interim superintendent has to deal with is the continuing question about just what's going to happen in Juneau. And jumping to Juneau for the moment, there seems to be a heating up of opposition. The State Chamber of Commerce and some others, Senator Shelley Hughes, have taken strong stances against income tax as one of the income sources solving the budget problem here. And along with that, setting up a continuing contrast, if you will, between the Senate and the House. And right now we're looking probably, it seems, at more than 90 days to finish up this session. Any comments about that, Mark?
Raise your hand if you're surprised. it doesn't, at this point, it's almost a waste of time to talk about it, because they haven't hit the 90 days in so long, or once in the last, what is it, 10 or 12 years or something.
Since they passed the measure.
They should just stop the charade and go back to 120.
Yeah, I think what you've got now is just a battle of the PR machines. The Alaska Chamber and Alaska or Anchorage Chamber have come out pretty fiercely. They've got an ad running that I thought was sort of, I got a chuckle that they used the same small business owner that Senator Dan Sullivan used in his campaign. So it's all, at this point, that positioning. Now, and there's no real urgency in a lot of their minds, because guess what? It's not an election year, folks. Next year, that's when things will get...
They're setting up an election showdown, mm-hmm, for mm-hmm, sure. It's mm-hmm. It's hard to believe that the state chamber is still saying things like cut, you know, just...
Well, cut and wait for the price of oil to rise.
Oh, that's even worse, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the magic sauce, though. That's the sauce they're all drinking out of.
I think the quote was, if the price of oil rises, we won't have a problem. Well, that's does not sound like sound footing for state fiscal policy to me.
Okay. Yeah, I think there would be some economics people in the state would take issue with that. I would with my own portfolio.
So if we're looking for a sound footing, let's turn to Washington, D.C. for a moment. Last week, we were doing this show, and we were talking about whether the repeal and replace action in the House would be successful or not. And, of course, what happened was the party proposing it, the Republican group, withdrew before having a vote. Let's see if we have any reaction, or is anyone surprised, or what do you think about all of that? Let's start with Mark again.
I'm not surprised. I'm surprised that they didn't take a little more time with the bill and come up with something that more people would support. It's a little bit on the mind-boggling side to me from that point. But given what they put forward and how they put it forward, no surprise at all that they didn't get the votes.
But they created their own urgency by pounding a drum for the last 8 years that they had to do something about it. Now, they could have stepped back and said, whoa, but that's just not the way this group operates. It's shove things through and ask questions later. And I think they are some big surprises as the deep divisions that go on. And that is always very interesting, depending on who's in the White House and who wants to try to get people to work together. And I think the messages from, you know, this president is not interested. He wants to run it the way he runs his business, and he's not afraid to bully people in business. That's a whole different thing when you start bullying people in Congress.
There was a comment made on one of the news programs this morning that I sort of, my ears perked up and I'm reminded about this. In reference to Mr. Trump and his businesses, he's been a CEO, but a CEO without a very strong board of directors. And someone was pointing out that if you were someone who was running, it could be GE or something else, pick a company that has a strong board of directors, and you have to work with that board. You can't just dominate. That's a very different experience base. And if you come off as essentially a sole provider with a very arguably weak board of directors that's basically going to agree with you, then you don't come into a situation with enough experience to do this kind of work that requires a lot of management and work. So just throwing that out. But let's turn to a very recent thing that just happened, where our own senior senator from Alaska caused the vice president to go to work. And by that, I mean she forced his voting to break a tie that involved funding basically for or taking away funding for Planned Parenthood. And that seemed to me to be a very gutsy move. Any comments about that?
Well, you know, I think she's been pretty clear on this subject. I've never seen her flip-flop on her support of Planned Parenthood, and Collins either. It doesn't surprise me. Two women are the ones that are flying the flag for women's rights to make their own reproductive choices. But, you know, it's something that she... You know, I wasn't very surprised. Was anybody else?
No.
No, and I think you could also make the case that she's having her cake and eating it too here because it won't come back to bite her. She can't have it hung on her in the next campaign that she caused Planned Parenthood to be funded because the party still got what they wanted.
Mm-hmm. And isn't this thing, you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, this thing is way not over because there'll be multiple lawsuits over this, I would guess.
Yeah. Okay. Just saying, she has occupied a center stage position here, though, because even though it took all of those other senators to vote in the way they did, she essentially broke ranks to do this. So very interesting, at least to me.
And if we're keeping score, that's the second time.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay. So now let's come on back to the Valley. I know, Zaz, you've been following a topic which, as I reviewed the materials, in fact, I think you just finished an article on a number of incidents involving troopers and shootings and canine dogs. You want to summarize that?
Yeah, there have been four officer-involved shootings involving troopers here and that, too, in less than a year, since June 2016. Three of them were fatal. And so while that doesn't in any way presume bad actions by troopers, it does certainly prompt a harder look, I think, among the public. And, you know, there are any number of people in the public who are all for what they see as bad guys getting shot by troopers when they do things to threaten troopers, trooper canines. Two of the four incidents involved dogs that were released to chase fleeing suspects, and both of those men shot and killed the dogs before troopers opened fire on the humans. And so one of the interesting aspects of this, it's not a trend, it's sort of a statistical blip, is that, because half of the incidents involved dogs, there's one dog handler, a guy, a trooper, Christopher Havens, who's been involved in three of the four incidents. And so, when I reported that story, it's in today's paper. I think that, what I was trying to be very careful about was not trying to malign Christopher Havens, mm-hmm. Who has in no way been found. Two of the incidents he was involved in have been found to be justified shootings. That means that they are not criminal. The troopers then investigate to make sure policy is followed, et cetera. Those investigations aren't necessarily, there's no big public hearing afterwards to say what happened, which I think is a larger story that I'll like to follow up on, just in terms of what lessons have been learned. How could this have gone differently? Troopers don't wake up in the morning wanting to shoot people. Mm-hmm. That's definitely not the outcome they're looking for. But the sort of overlay on these shootings is the presence of police dogs. And so, troopers are, I think, reexamining their canine policies in light of these incidents. And, always when use of force is involved, they go back and look at what happened. And so I wonder if this will in any way prompt a policy change on the use of canines in pursuits, because it changes the mix for sure to have a dog introduced in.
So what is it? Have you looked, Zaz, to see statistically how many canines are, killed in other areas?
I had 5 hours to put that story together.
Yeah, it'd be interesting.
So I still have a lot more work to do.
Yeah, that would be interesting to know how other communities, if they've lost and if their protocol is different than mm-hmm. what we have. I think, it seems like the canines definitely serve a purpose, but there could be some changes, like you say, in policy that make everybody safer. But it'd be interesting to mm-hmm. evaluate it.
Well, one thing on this statistical side, given our population, four officer-involved shootings in a year or so is a way higher per capita rate than anywhere else in the country.
It's just not statistically valid because it's such a short period. It may be because there were canines involved. I tried to talk with people who could tell me whether this exactly that was an issue. Well, how does this compare to Anchorage? Mm-hmm. It was apples and oranges just because it's such a short sample period.
Mm. What is our crime rate in comparison? We have a per capita crime rate.
I don't know. I know that one of the public responses to these officer-involved shootings was, well, this is happening either because of SB 91, which isn't accurate, or because there's so much more crime here in the Valley, which also isn't really accurate. There, you know, there are spikes in property crimes in certain parts of the Valley, but you know, on the troopers level and on municipal, you know, Palmer, Westville police levels, there has not been a statistically huge, a significant spike in crime in the Valley. There are a lot of questions as to why this is happening.
I keep hoping someone will start a Valley Mythbuster page and just start pointing out, not just about this, but, you know, just listening about things on the budget and certain things that people just go off the rails on without having accurate information.
Yeah, you know, I
think that's part of it. People would, you know, should know the truth of what's going on instead of just the surface, you know, facts, the alternate facts, let's say that.
Well, and the social media frenzy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And to cycle back to the discussion about budget, I know the communities to the south of Anchorage, particularly those heading toward Girdwood and beyond on the long, lonely highway there, are certainly concerned about decreases in numbers of troopers, and their availability, and all the rest of it. And to some degree, also here in the Valley, there's a concern that troopers are getting to be spread very thin.
Oh, that's a huge concern.
And so when you start talking about, well, even a trooper that would be involved in a number of incidents, if you had once had five troopers and now you have one or two, that's going to increase the incident per trooper situation for and just that fact alone. And of course, the other underlying question is that in the incidents we've talked about, the perpetrators have had guns that they were not only in possession of, but willing to use.
Mm-hmm.
And that is another question and concern about how approaching anyone with even a couple of taillights out, whether they're going to be armed and dangerous.
So. Yeah, one person of the four did have a knife, but was you know, threatening troopers with a knife and was very erratic.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, and also, just to go back to that a little second, just with the population changes, it's sprawl, too. It's not just that we don't have as many troopers on the job, but people are living very far apart now. So you have that population is one thing, but people are kind of sprawled out everywhere, and there's, you know, there's repercussions of that, too. And then you go back to what you said about Girdwood. Haynes has no trooper now. So we just haven't had enough time even in that to see what the trickle-down effect of that is going to have as far as, you know, the crime in our state, I think.
Well, and this was not a factor in the four shootings that I looked at since June. And there have been, I think it's 10 trooper-involved shootings statewide since 2013. And I don't think this was a factor in any of them, but sprawl, Terry, when you bring that up, you know, if you're a trooper responding to a domestic violence call in Trapper Creek, if you're responding alone, it could be a long time before another trooper can get up there.
Yeah.
And that was not a factor in any of the shootings I looked at recently.
Right.
But certainly that weighs on your mind if you're a sole trooper responding to an incident that could get out of control.
Okay, well, let us come back
to... Good articles, Oz.
Yes. Let's come back to the city of Palmer. The city of Palmer has a defined identity and location. And as we have mentioned sometimes in the past, however, the services that the city of Palmer provides extend beyond its borders. And so for a number of years, particularly the Palmer Fire Department has responded because it's the closest to areas just outside of the city, which are part of the borough. And at the recent city council meeting, the city manager brought this up, pointing out that as he looked over the agreements, and in particular, and in part, this is sort of tied to the changes in the dispatch center, if Palmer Fire resources, personnel, and equipment is going to go out, there's a suggestion that they would be under the control of the Palmer Fire Department and dispatch. But if they're going into the borough, will now, with the changes that are happening, the dispatch and control be from Wasilla or the borough? And what are the agreements in terms of cost factors, et cetera? Because when there is a response, the general idea is that the Palmer Fire Department will be compensated for doing this outside of its area, but in a normal area. This is beyond the kind of thing that's talked about when we have mutual aid agreements where there's a huge thing happening in the city, the borough come in and out and so on. But it speaks to an artifact of the growth in the area and changes in the processes that have been in place. And I suspect there's going to be a considerable discussion to fix this up as one part of this changing dispatch center and the rest of it. Terry, you were there. Any comments?
No, I think it's something they have to take a look at. And I think you're going to just see people looking at the fine print of their contracts and sort of what I call gentleman agreements, because most of them were done by the guys, between, you know, bodies, municipalities, cities, boroughs. And there's a lot of cost shifting going on from the state to the local governments. You're going to see the local governments, their cooperation between each other get a harder look, too, because everybody's looking at their bottom line. So I think that Palmer should be looking at those agreements and taking a thoughtful approach to them.
And, of course, there's the other piece here, too. And, Terry, you were sitting in on one of the budget presentations that was made with a large group of personnel from the borough that were going to speak to their needs in budget. How about a quick summary of that before we finish?
Oh, you know, it's not a quick summary. There is a really good explanation. I think Patty Sullivan did a pretty good job on the borough website. It's got a lot of little clips of the conversation. I'd get people to particularly listen to the part about the tax cap or the revenue cap. It's sort of interchangeable. People don't understand that. And I think it's worth people understanding that. But they are challenged this year, particularly the school district is now having a big deficit, and they are looking for more of a local contribution, at least equal to what the other five districts get. And they all don't know, because there's this looming 5% across the board cut to education as a whole, which will dig them even deeper in at the tune of around $19 million. So it is... it's going to be something to watch at the end, how they balance all of those things. And the borough has been living off of savings, so to speak, and their own slush funds, as some has referred to it as, and what they've been able to keep for a rainy day. And their rainy day account is getting less and less, too. So all these people that are running around like Chicken Little talking about cuts, I don't know where they think they're going to cut. Most of those cuts have been made, and we're already starting to see them as impacted in our community. I'm seeing it here in downtown Palmer, just less people.
So what do you think, a mill rate increase this year?
I don't think that they've set the stage for it. I think there's a lot of more education that needs to happen. There's a possibility they may look to a local or a seasonal sales tax. It would have to be a special election. But I think the public still needs to be educated on where they're at with it. They still don't understand clearly what they're getting taxed for, why it's as much as it is. They don't understand density, and they just know where it affects their own pocketbook. I think there needs to be more explanation.
Okay, well, we've got a little bit of time to do that still.
Yeah.
And we have come to the end of another edition of Valley Edition. So I want to thank Zaz Hollander for calling in.
Sure thing. Thanks, everybody.
And I want to thank Terry Snyder for coming into the studio.
Thanks, Mike. Have a good weekend.
And I want to thank Mark Kelsey for also coming in.
You bet. Have a good week, everybody.
All right. We'll be back next week. Thank you.